This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You have to wish they'd come up with better names for these things, right? iPad? Really? And Kindle? What's that? Today, the competition really began. Amazon takes on Apple. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 28th of September today. Analysts call it first-mover advantage. Consumers call it getting the cool new gadgets before everybody else does. But whatever you call it, Apple has it, first with the iPhone and then with the iPad. The past 5 years or so, Apple has been able to take huge chunks of whatever mobile market it wants, which is why what was basically a public relations event in New York today was really such a big deal. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos pulled back the curtain on one of the most hotly anticipated gadgets of the season, the Kindle Fire, it's called. It's billed as being more than just another e-reader, and Bezos fervently hopes a worthy competitor to the aforementioned iPad. From WNYC in New York City, Ilya Maritz reports.
The Kindle Fire offers all the things earlier Kindles didn't: movies and music, magazines in full color, and video games. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos demonstrated his virtual pineapple chopping skills on a game called Fruit Ninja.
I also have to admit, I find this a little uncomfortably therapeutic.
It's easy to understand why Bezos might crave a little mindless relaxation. The Kindle Fire is going up against the iPad in a competitive arena where other tablets have gone to die. Like the iPad, the Fire is mostly screen, and you operate it by touch. But the Fire is smaller, just 7.5 inches. And something else is smaller, too. The price.
It's $199.
You could buy 4 Kindle Fires for the cost of 1 souped-up iPad.
That's Sarah Rotman Epps, a tech analyst with Forrester Research. Epps says Amazon may be selling the Fire at a loss. That's because the online retailer wants the Fire to function mainly as a virtual shopping cart.
Putting this device in consumers' hands guarantees that they will be a pretty serious Amazon spender.
Loading up on digital content like music and books, and maybe some pots and pans, too. Analysts predict sales of the Fire could top 3 million this year. The tablet ships on November 15th, in plenty of time for you-know-what. In New York, I'm Ilya Maritz for Marketplace.
We're learning more today about a slow-motion case of fatal food contamination that's spreading across the country. At least 13 people have died. More than 70 have gotten sick eating cantaloupe tainted by a bacteria called Listeria. The outbreak apparently started back in late July. The company that grew the melons in question issued a recall earlier this month. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
To see how these outbreaks can affect businesses, it helps to look at previous cases. Bob Martin is general manager at Rio Farms in King City, California. It's a big farm that grows a lot of vegetables, salad greens, peppers, onions. He remembers what happened when an outbreak of E. coli was traced to bagged spinach in 2006.
There was a lot of spinach that was never even harvested, and then it came back very, very slowly.
3 weeks after the outbreak was announced, bagged spinach sales had dropped by more than 60%. More than a year later, sales were still down 10%. And it wasn't just bagged spinach. Regular spinach sales, that's the stuff that's not pre-bagged, fell more than 30%, and customers cut back on bagged salads for a while, too. Trevor Suslow studies food safety at the University of California, Davis. He says the economic effects of a recall ripple all the way through the food chain.
It always affects orders, and it affects sales. Retailers anticipating a drop in sales start canceling orders.
An outbreak of E. coli several years ago that was tied to cantaloupes from Mexico caused a big drop in cantaloupe sales, but sales of Mexican honeydews were unaffected. Produce industry officials say it's too soon after the recall of the tainted Colorado cantaloupes to know the potential damage to the melon industry this time, but the Food and Drug Administration said today it expects more illnesses and possibly deaths from the tainted cantaloupes. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Google is known for its searches, its email, its attempts at social networking. Google Plus, anybody? But solar power? Yeah, not right at the top of the list. Google did say today, though, that it's going to invest more, in fact, in the renewable energy market. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Google owns solar panels, coming soon to a rooftop near you. Seriously, the internet giant wants to pay to put solar panels on 3,000 homes with an initial investment of $75 million.
Google is going to increasingly be the company that's going to be in all of our households. They're going to want to power everything we use.
Justin Malavi is a senior analyst at Ibis World.
Just because they're doing well in the internet doesn't mean that they can't break off into other interests of theirs.
I ask him why Google, a company known for its internet searches and email, wants to own rooftop solar panels. Simple, he says, Google sees a good business opportunity. Homeowners will pay Google a monthly bill for their solar power. Google will also be able to take advantage of government incentives. This isn't Google's first foray into renewable energy. The company's total investment is now around $850 million.
They're like a new bank for clean energy to some degree.
Ethan Zindler is an analyst with Bloomberg New Energy Finance. He says there are also long-term reasons for Google to invest in renewable energy.
Google has obviously substantial energy needs. It runs major server farms and eventually, you know, would like to be able to have power, dedicated power, from clean energy projects in which they are paying relatively low costs.
So is Google on its way to being as synonymous with renewable energy as it is with search? No time soon, says Zindler. But right now, it is helping to lead the way. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
One more solar note of note before we move on. Remember Solyndra, the bankrupt solar company that got $500 million in government loan guarantees? Well, nothing about them today, but the Energy Department did approve almost $1 billion in guarantees for two other solar firms today, one each in Nevada and Arizona. The Department of Energy spokesman did say the finances of both parent companies had gotten a most thorough going over. On Wall Street today, oil was down, gold was down, copper was down. I could go on, but you get my drift. The major indices took their cue from Europe. Again, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know how analysts always say the markets hate uncertainty? Well, I'm not sure German Chancellor Angela Merkel got the memo. She said in an interview last night that the terms of the EU's Greek rescue package might have to be renegotiated. Not the most calming of things to say as the German parliament gets ready to vote on a big bailout package tomorrow and Friday. The economic hand-wringing to date has largely been about the larger picture, European economic stability. But Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from Berlin that it's really about something more fundamental, the money in people's pockets.
This pacemaker manufacturer must be having palpitations. The boss, Christoph Boehmer, is getting alarmed about the euro crisis because the currency has been great for his business.
We do the majority of our business in the eurozone, and with the euro, there's no currency risk in that eurozone. That's been of incredible help.
So you like the euro?
We absolutely do like the euro.
17 countries with a combined population bigger than the United States have adopted the euro. The currency has turned these countries into a giant playground for Germany's all-powerful exporters. Philipp Schlottberler is with the German Chambers of Commerce.
We have a common market with one single currency and without any transaction costs. The export from Germany to France or to Slovakia is the same as an export from New York to Texas or to California.
Since the euro was launched 12 years ago, German exporters have done well for a less obvious reason. The old Deutschmark would likely be much stronger than the European currency today. So Germany has kept its products priced competitively on the world market. This might explain the Greek Prime Minister's very respectful hearing in Berlin yesterday when he addressed a group of German business people.
I promise you, we Greeks will soon fight our way back to growth and prosperity after this period of pain.
If George Papandreou's audience had been made up of the German public, it might not have applauded. 80% opposed the transfer of any more money, especially to Greece. But political scientist Henrik Enderlein says business and political leaders in Germany now face a stark choice.
What's more costly, transfers to Greece and potentially other countries today, or accepting the costs of a failure of the euro area?
The costs of a euro collapse could be horrendous. The whole region could be plunged into turmoil, says German economist Katinka Barisch.
There would not be only a massive run on all European banks. There would be a collapse in exports. There would be a deep, deep recession. The economic losses would be exponential.
Germany would be especially hard hit, its banks having lent an estimated $1.5 trillion to Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland and Italy. If Germany reverted to the Deutschmark, that currency might soar and in the process cripple German exporters. Most analysts say the German parliament will pass the bailout package tomorrow. Twelve years ago, when the euro was launched, a multinational choir sang Land of Hope and Glory outside the European Central Bank in Frankfurt. This now has a hollow ring. There doesn't seem much hope or glory in Euroland today. In Berlin, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The economic debates happening on each side of the Atlantic Ocean aren't really about economics, right? It's all politics. And what solutions to which problems are palatable? What makes growth happen? How do you create recovery out of a recession? Commentator David Frum says the answers are, as we're all learning, more complicated than anybody thought.
How to respond to economic ups and downs? It used to be that the dividing line was clear. Liberals favored active government measures, government spending to fight recessions, tax increases to curtail inflation. Conservatives, by contrast, preferred monetary instruments, raise interest rates to stop inflation, loosen money during recessions. In the 1970s and 1980s, the conservative point of view gained ascendancy. For a long time, the new approach seemed to work brilliantly. The inflation of the 1970s was suppressed. And then, between 1983 and 2007, the United States enjoyed what came to be called the Great Moderation, a quarter century of very low inflation punctuated only by two mild recessions, the smoothest growth path in American economic history. The Great Moderation has ended in the Great Recession. Interest rates have been cut to near zero, and still there's not much of a recovery. At this zero bound, liberals have rediscovered their old faith in active government, fiscal stimulus, government spending. Conservatives might have been expected to reply by re-emphasizing new possibilities in monetary policy, the now famous concept of quantitative easing. Instead, many conservatives have changed their minds. They have turned against quantitative easing. They call for tighter money, not to battle inflation, there isn't any, but they think the value of the dollar is best measured against the price of some selection of commodities, especially gold, silver, and oil. It's not about the prices most Americans pay anymore. Why, in a universe of prices, it is these almost randomly selected prices that should govern is never very well explained. Explained or not, the view is strongly held, to the point where Texas Governor Rick Perry accused Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke of treason for thinking otherwise. Yet there remain only two policy levers, fiscal and monetary, and if you refuse to pull either, you are condemned to do nothing except wait for the economy to improve on its own. That's left some of us a little isolated. More importantly, it has left conservatives with little useful to say about the greatest economic challenges of our time.
In an earlier life, David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Today, he's the editor of Frum Forum. Coming up next week, Robert Reich. Your comments at your convenience, as always. Go to marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. Coming up, they don't only make cars in Detroit, you know.
Everyone and their brother are going, they're in school to be a nurse right now. I mean, everybody knows at least five people, I swear.
But first, let's do the numbers. All right, really, do I even have to tell you why the markets were down today? Yeah, I guess I do. That's why they do these, right? It's Europe. The Dow Industrial slid 1.6%, 179 points, closed at 11,010 today. The NASDAQ raised 2.1%, 55 points, ended at 2491. The S&P 500 gave back 2%, 24 points, ended at 1151. Financial firms took a dive on worries over Greece. JPMorgan Chase threw off 3.5%. Citigroup reversed 4%. Bank of America parted with 5% of its share price. Sinking commodity prices took down Freeport-McMoRan. Mining company's shares fell more than 7%. Cliffs Natural Resources lost nearly 8.5%. The new Kindle Fire we told you about lit a flame, but don't bump under Amazon. Its shares bumped up 2.5% today. But the tablet's debut barely singed Apple. Its shares were off just about 0.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Innocentive, solving important problems for business, government, and foundations by connecting them to problem solvers from around the world. Innocentive.com, where the world innovates. Entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing resource to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/marketing. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Listen to the numbers on your own time. Download the new Marketplace Radio iPhone app for on-demand access to all of our radio programs right on your iPhone. Coming soon for the Android.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues its final gross domestic product report for the second quarter. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for August. And 3 years ago, on September 29th, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped almost 778 points, its biggest one-day point loss in history. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You want to sign the low end of the retail economy's doing all right for itself? Try this one on. The Family Dollar chain reported record fourth quarter sales this morning, an 8% jump in profits, and it said it's going to open maybe 500 more stores in the coming year. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins explains how Family Dollar has set itself apart from all its 99-cent cousins.
Walk into almost any 99-cent retailer, and this is what you'll find.
A lot of them tend to be, you know, pretty sloppy.
Anthony Chakumba is an analyst with BB&T Capital Markets.
A lot of out of stocks, so you're not sure what you're going to get on any given day.
Prices at stores like Dollar General and Dollar Tree have pulled customers away from Walmart, whose U.S. sales have been soft for several months. Bruce Cohen is a retail strategist at Kurt Salmon.
Consumers are always looking for a great deal, and now more than ever.
But the Walmart shopper is used to stopping by a superstore and always finding things like milk. So Anthony Chikumba says Family Dollar is making sure customers come back by restocking the necessities. In addition to those treasure hunt items like the hula skirt in December, regular items now include shampoo, cereal, and dish soap.
They're really trying to improve the shopping experience, you know, for the customer. And I think that's something that particularly resonates with these trade-down customers,
who are looking for even better deals than Walmart can provide. But customers also want a nice shopping experience. So Family Dollar is remodeling stores and promoting them like this.
New Family Dollar stores feature bright new colors, clear, convenient signs, and a larger assortment of products than ever.
And with more stores opening next year, analysts expect this new recipe to work. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Remember the last time you bought a plane ticket and how much it cost? How airlines come to determine the price of that ticket is something called dynamic pricing, an algorithm type thing that tells them when to charge what for which seat. Our man from Silicon Valley, Steve Henn, did a piece last week that explained all that, and he said other industries are beginning to use the same method to price whatever they sell. Which sounds fine and all, but Evelyn Kirison from Boca Raton, Florida, thinks it smacks of a bad deal. Dynamic pricing, she writes, is no more or less than a 21st century form of haggling. It is unfair, immoral, and should be outlawed. It shows the true degenerate nature of unregulated capitalism. We mentioned the Justice Department last week and its spendthrift ways. A recent audit had found the DOJ has been paying way too much for food at conferences, like $32 a head for Cracker Jacks or $16 for a muffin. From Washington, D.C., Daniel Glucksman wrote to say, please, hold the outrage.
$16 for a continental breakfast is not uncommon. In fact, actually, it's a pretty good deal. Because on top of that, we also pay gratuity, usually 22%, and then tax on top of that. Want a filet mignon for dinner? That's about $70. Now you know why attending a conference sometimes costs $1,000. It's all in the food.
Mr. Glucksman comes by his knowledge honestly. He is, for a living, an event planner. Finally, today we got a lot of comments for an interview we ran on education reform with New York University professor Diane Ravitch last week. In a nutshell, she said, don't just blame teachers for bad grades. Parents have something to do with it, too. Jillian Saito from Oak Park, Illinois, says, sure, but also important is this, she writes, the support the faculty and administration gives the teachers, seminars and training. And that's it. If you've got a comment, you know what to do. By now, go to our website, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Remember all the Sturm und Drang about the healthcare reform law? How political it all got? You ain't seen nothing yet. Today, the Obama administration asked the Supreme Court to take up the case. It's an appeal of a lower court decision that had struck down a key part of the law, the individual mandate, the part that said everybody has to buy insurance. All of which is to say that if the justices do take the case, chances are the ruling is going to land right smack in the middle of the 2012 presidential election. The basic idea of the whole reform law was to control healthcare costs in a part of the economy where costs are growing, but so too are jobs. And that's where Detroit, Michigan comes in. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Gregory Warner reports.
How'd you do?
I think I did okay.
67 students are recovering from their last final of the day at the Oakland University School of Nursing in Detroit. Kara Thoit, one of the students, tells me that hers is the new face of Detroit.
Everyone and their brother are going, they're in school to be a nurse right now. I mean, everybody knows at least five people, I swear.
Everybody around here is nodding, so I guess it's everybody's experience.
Yeah.
This is a special accelerated program that attracts students from other careers. Lawyers, airline pilots, some automotive engineers. Kara Thoit herself worked in school administration. So why is it that so many workers in the City of Champions are turning to healthcare?
The money and the demand, you know, there's always going to be a job somewhere.
This program has a job placement rate of 100%. Every graduate has gotten a job. And that would be reason for celebration in any city. But in Detroit, with 16% unemployment, it sounds like a cry of redemption.
Healthcare is going to be one of those key areas
aiding the city of Detroit to turn around.
John King is consultant to the Detroit Workforce Development Board. It oversees $60 million in federal funds for job training programs.
And that includes training for lots and lots and lots of healthcare workers.
And that makes healthcare workers very confident. And when people feel like they're part of a boom, they spend like it. Jeff Axt owns one of the city's largest women's clothing stores, Bizarre Collection. That's spelled B-I-Z-R.
Definitely color is what we're known for here at Bizarre. So if the department store has it in black and brown, we'll have it in yellow, white, lilac, and mint.
He's talking there about shoes, by the way. Axt says that healthcare workers are often his best customers. Call it the Bizarre Confidence Index. He's noticed that healthcare workers are often even more confident consumers than people in other jobs, like auto workers and school teachers.
But you see it on the ground in the healthcare industry when you're like a neighbor of a healthcare provider.
Or you see it if you're selling them shoes.
And if you're seeing them selling them shoes. If they're booked to the hill on their clinic for the next 6 months, you have a lot different psychology than if you're worried about them shutting down your assembly line.
Shutting down your assembly line or firing workers, in part to pay for skyrocketing health costs. And this irony hasn't been lost on business owners. They have mixed feelings about whether or not this federal money to train healthcare workers is a good thing when healthcare expansion drives up the cost of care. Doug Rothwell is president and CEO of Business Leaders from Michigan.
We are concerned about, for example, you know, how many medical schools do we need in the state? How many state-of-the-art technology centers? Those all add to cost. On the other hand, we do recognize that it is driving some, you know, net wealth creation.
And small businesses are cropping up to get a piece of that wealth. It's around the hospitals and the university that you find the organic food stores, the pet sitter shop and art gallery. None of this was here 5 years ago. And as opposed to the auto industry, healthcare's workforce is younger, more diverse, more female, and maybe more likely to flaunt their success. At least that could explain the healthy sales of Bizarre's flashy, crystal-encrusted cowboy boots.
The leather is distressed and cracked, and then it has Swarovski crystal rhinestones in an eagle pattern up front and up the shaft. It's a $1,500 Western boot, and we sell it 12 months a year.
And that's consumer confidence. In Detroit, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the knowledge effect. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of, yeah, we all kind of knew that. You remember those easy tone sneakers that Reebok promised would firm up your derriere? No. The company agreed to offer $25 million in refunds today to settle claims by the Federal Trade Commission of false advertising. Turns out, shockingly, there's no actual science to back up Reebok's claims that the shoes could do what they said they would do. So your tushy's on its own. We're going to leave it right there. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow slid 1.2%, about 179 points. The NASDAQ off 2.1%, 55 points. The S&P 500 gave back 2%, 24 points. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back on The Big Show, Life Online.
What does all this connectedness mean? Kind of where did it come from? And where could we possibly take it?
Big questions, big answers. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.